Accession number 10266, reel number 2.
Mr. George Bryce, reel 2. The another duty you had, which leads on to our next topic, is you had something to do with setting the compasses for the flying boats and Sopwith Camels. Could you explain what exactly that responsibility was?
Yes. The points of the compass were, the 8 major points were painted on the concrete in front of the hangars. And the machines, both the Sopwith Camels and the flying boats, had to have their compasses periodically adjusted. They were wheeled out onto the concrete, and a plumb line was attached to the nose and the tail, and they were placed on the machine was wheeled onto the compass point until it says, we'll say, north. Now, due to the amount of metal in the machines, the compass reading would not necessarily be true north. And at the side of the Sopwith Camel compass were little slots in which you put very fine magnets about the size of a needle, and you put those in until you got your reading as near as possible to the indication on the floor. Having got that, you made a note of it, and at the side of the compass was a slot with a card in it, and it was marked with the points of the compass, north, south, east, west, so on. And you placed against north so many degrees so that the pilot knew what the variation was, you see. And that was the answer.
And that was the only work you did on the planes? The
aircraft. Yes. I wasn't required to do anything else.
Was it difficult to balance the compasses?
No, it was what I would call a finicky job, because you see, you had to go over the same ground more than once, because you, having got the north settled, you see, you would automatically think that the south would be correspondingly correct, but it wasn't so. So you had to move the magnets again, you see, and you had to move these magnets between the 8 major points to get the nearest you could possibly get to the true bearing on the compass.
Would some planes be particularly difficult?
Well, yes, the bigger flying boats, which were even for World War I, were quite sizable aircraft. They were quite complicated. It took really some time to sort of really get them down to as near correct as you possibly could.
About how long?
Well, you probably spend half to three quarters of an hour on that one machine, you see.
And on a camel, how long?
Well, the camels didn't take so long, because it's a much simpler thing altogether. I should think probably 20 minutes to half an hour, and we could deal with a camel quite comfortably.
Would you be doing it on your own? It was a one-man job.
Well, yes, except that the working party which I referred to, they were the chaps who had to move the machine round, you see, while I sat in the machine and waited for them. And the chap used to call out, direction north, you see, and then I'd start playing around with the magnets.
Do you remember anything particular? As you know, we have Cully's Camel in the War Museum. Do you remember anything particular about that machine?
No, I don't remember anything about it except that in 1919, when was this museum opened?
The first establishment, I think, was around about then.
That's right.
Not well, in this building.
Well, the first year it was opened, I think it was either 1919 or 1920, I came up to London for a few days' holiday, came over here, and was quite astonished to see the machine there, you see. It was suspended then in those days, I don't know what it is now. And with the caption underneath that it was a machine that Flight Lieutenant Cully had flown, and I hadn't seen it from that day.
So you knew you must have set all the compasses for all the planes. So that's why you knew you must have set Cully's.
Yes. Oh, I knew it was Cully's because I had received information in the morning to get this machine ready as they were going out in the afternoon. And
this would be on the 10th of August.
That's right. And they went. After I finished with the machine, it was wheeled down the slipway and put onto the lighter, which had a platform built out of it. And that was taken out, attached to the stern of the destroyer, and the machine and the lighter and the destroyer were escorted by a cruiser, and off they went.
Had you seen much of these take-off lighters and such like?
Well, I remember very clearly the experiments when they first started it.
What do you remember about that?
Well, there was a very famous First World War pilot, Commander Sampson. And he conceived this idea of flying a Sopwith Camel off a lighter. And he was a chap who never asked anybody to do a job unless he had done it himself. So when the platform was finished, and the shipwrights had finished building it, they put the machine on there, and he said, "Right, I'll take her off." Well, he got in the machine and he revved it up, and they had removed the wheels and put metal skids, you see, so that it would slide on guide rails on the platform. And he started up the engine, and away she went, and went straight over the side into the water. Of course, they picked him up. He was soaking wet. He said a few kind words in naval language and said, "The damn thing's got to go up. I'll go and get changed." He went back to his quarters.
You actually saw these?
Yes, I saw this. He went back to his quarters, came back, got in the machine, and flew it off perfectly. And from then on, that was what decided they would use it.
Do you remember anything else about Cully's flight? You saw it go out. You saw the lighter being towed out.
Yes, well, we saw that disappeared. Then we didn't know anything at all until the middle of the next afternoon, when news had been transmitted by radio to the naval authorities at Harwich that the Zeppelin had been brought down, and the cruiser and the destroyer and the lighter came in from the sea, past the entrance to the, and all the chaps on the beach were raising their hats and cheering. And but I don't remember after that. I mean, Cully was a very unobtrusive sort of chap. And
do you remember anything about him at all, other than that?
No, except that he was a tall, fair-haired chap and quite quite friendly, I mean, considering, because in those days the difference between the officer and the rating was very, very marked. But I was fortunate in the ones that I dealt with, they were very good.
Do you remember any of the other pilots? Or any other characters?
No, I've got one or two photographs of one or two of the other pilots. In fact, I was wondering whether if any photographs would be any good to you.
I should imagine so. We'll discuss it later.
Yeah.
When you'd set a compass, something I should have asked earlier, how long did it stay set for? Or would you have to do it before almost every flight or every five flights?
Well, there was a rotor, because obviously we couldn't do all the compasses every day, you know. But there was a rotor that after so many hours flying, which I forget, then it was time for it to be done again, you see. And I would get the notice over.
So what would your daily routine be for a typical day? It's a bit difficult to remember now.
Well, the first thing in the morning would be to deal with these notices to mariners, which I mentioned to you.
That's the Admiralty map, or later on the RAF map.
That's right. You put all that information, brought all that information up to date.
And what time would you start that?
Oh, about, let's see, we used to start about 8 o'clock in the morning, yes, and go on until 6 in the evening.
What would your second task be?
The other minor weekly task was to set the barograph in the officer's mess. We had to renew the sheet and record the figures from the previous week for Admiralty purposes, and then it would largely depend on what operations were taking place. If there were no operations and no charts required, then I would revert to that other thing I was telling you about, making the necessary drawing.
Special jobs like when you made the ferry pilot.
That's right. Yes, I do that. That's right.
So, in a sense, you didn't really have much of a daily routine. It all depended on what came up.
No.
And you just... the one thing that you did do was you always did the maps.
Yes.
The Admiralty map,
yes,
or whatever.
Yes, that's right.
After that, the day was sort of broken up into... as the number of operations and such like depended.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Where did you live at the time?
At that time? Well... I was in what they call number one mess, which was number one hut. And we were a cosmopolitan lot in that. In most of the huts, all the fellas on one job would be in one hut, you see. But in hut number one, there was myself and... Tursi chaps who were writers in the ship's office, and a couple of other fellows who used to drive the cars. You know, we were odds and sods, as you might say.
Did you get on well with them?
Oh, very well, very well. And then when the influx from the RAF came in with the older men... the accommodation was very limited. I mean, we were actually over strength. And I was able to... I was allowed to live outside the station.
In billets?
In a billet, yes. And I stayed with a lady named Mrs... Care, I think her name was, in Felixstowe. I had my own room, and I used to ride from Felixstowe down to the air station on a bicycle.
You seem to have quite enjoyed your time.
Oh, I did.
Once you got onto this chart room job.
Pardon?
Once you got onto the chart room job,
Once I got onto the chart room, I was quite happy. And
did you ever think you were a well-educated man? Did you ever think of trying to become a pilot or trying to become an officer or doing that sort of thing?
Well, no, because let's be frank, I had a sort of self-preservation lookout in view of the fact that I'd lost my brother, and my mother begged me not to go up in an aeroplane, which on a young man of 18 or 19 had a certain amount of influence, as you can imagine.
So you never got a flight?
Oh, yes, I got a flight, yes, because we wanted to, in making these drawings of these light buoys and mooring buoys, we knew what the markings were, but we wanted to get the angle from a machine, so I went up with them in the nose of the F2A in what was the gunner's room and sort of observed made quick sketches of one or two of these boys so that we could draw them as they would appear.
Did you do that more than once?
No, only ever went to once.
What did you think of it then?
I wasn't tremendously impressed. I do know this, that I was very nearly court-martialed for it, because I went down and I got on the machine and I had I didn't have any flying kit on. I had my ordinary uniform cap. And we got up to about 500 feet, and I was just beginning to take notice of what I had to, and the wind whipped my cap off. Well, the pilots were directly behind me, and fortunately, they had a sort of a windscreen, and the cap hit the windscreen, bounced back, and I caught it and put it in there. But when we got down, the chap who was the pilot, he used a bit of naval language and told me exactly where I got off. The next time I went anywhere, I was to make sure I had helmet and goggles on, not wear a cap.
Were there any more incidents you remember as the war went on, before armistice? Anything in particular comes to mind?
Yes, I can remember the first moonless Zeppelin raid we had.
Do you know when that was?
You know, the Zeppelins used to come over when there was a moon, but this particular night, a Zeppelin came over, there was no moon. Well, when the air raid alarm sounded, unless you were on duty, you had to go to the dugouts, which you had no excuse. You had to go to the dugout, you see. Well, this alarm went on a moonless night when nobody was expecting them. So, of course, the chaps tumbled out of their hammocks in various stages of dress and undress and went to the shelter. In the station magazine the following month, there was a drawing of the entrance to the escape place.
Shelter.
And a line of chaps in various states of undress waiting to go in. And underneath it had, "Even Solomon in all his glory was not air raid like one of these."
Any other incidents?
Oh, yes, indeed. The other incident which I always remember, in the when these machines, especially the flying boats, when they were wheeled out of the hangar, because they were very, very large and ungainly looking things. And in order to turn them, they were put on, they had a sort of, how shall I describe it? But it was a set of wheels on a framework which which were moved by hand, and the machine would be pointing that way and you want to point that way. Well, you couldn't turn the machine, but what you did at the end of the axles was about that much showing, you see.
It was 3 inches.
And there would be a half a dozen chaps on the end of a lever, would put that lever under there, lift it up, so they can move round to the other wheels, you see. Well, as I say, you only had about 2 inches. If you took it in too far, you didn't get the necessary leverage, you see. And in this particular instance, these chaps got the thing there, and when they went down on it, the thing scarcely moved at all. And Petty Officer Doyle, who was an Irishman in charge of the working party, he said, take the damn thing out and put it in properly so that you can get it lifted up, you see. And the famous naval command was, when they were ready, he said, right, 2-6, heave. And the chap had been so scared, he'd only just caught it in underneath, you see, with the consequence was the bloody lever flipped off and the six of them fell flat on their face, you see. And I can see Doyle now, he went, that's right, he said, go from the sublime to the goblime, eh?
Do you remember the armistice at all?
Oh, very well.
What did you...
Oh, very well. I was in the... I was on duty in the chart room, and it was about 10 o'clock on the morning of Armistice Day, and a fellow came over from the wireless station and said, didn't do any more work, Bryce. I said, why? He said, Armistice is at 11 o'clock. I said, get away, I pull on my leg. No, he said, Armistice 11 o'clock. Well, of course, the buzz very quickly went through the camp, and in a matter of minutes, the fellows, irrespective of whether they were on duty or whether they were not, they were streaming out of the gates of the camp, making for Felixstowe Town and Ipswich, which was the nearest big town. And they got into Ipswich and really painted the town red.
And did you go as well?
Yes, and I remember the famous Dickens Hotel in Ipswich, the White Horse, I think it is. It was so packed. Those that were in, and those that were out, and nobody could move or anything like that, you see. And they were shouting up to the upper windows, come down and let us in, we want a drink, you see. And so one particular lot, I know, they just said, you want a drink? Oh, we'll get you one, you see. And they came to the door with the gazunders and poured the top. Anyway, when it came, I got back to the camp because we could go by train, you see, from Felixstowe. I got back to the camp, and chaps were absolutely, completely adrift. Well, we had two or three very big lorries, almost like the lorry that they move furniture in today. which were really they were used for storing and for going out to breakdowns and things like that. And a couple of the drivers got these lorries and they drove from Felixstowe to Ipswich at about any time between 1 and 2 in the morning, and any chap in naval uniform they saw staggering along the road, they picked him up and brought him in, brought him back to the camp. And then the following morning, on the 12th, what really annoyed everybody was we never found out who was the station officer on duty, but at 8 o'clock the following morning, he had the fire alarm sounded. And when the fire alarm sounded, you had a fire station to report to, you see. Well, of course, half the damn station didn't have anybody on them, you see, at all. And they took the names of the chaps who were missing. But it was a very unpopular move, I can tell you.
Did you carry on in the chart room till your demobilisation?
Yes, right till I was...
You were demobilised February 1919,
yeah,
weren't you?
Yeah.
Did your duties change at all after the end of the war?
No, because we were still... Sorry. We were still... they were still flying planes, you see, between Felixstowe and the other parts of the... I mean, we used to cover right up to Scapa Flow in Scotland, you see. And we also had a detachment of American airmen, which were sent to us for training, and they used to go off on these flights for that, you see. So we were kept moderately busy.
Were you looking forward to your... demobilisation, or were you quite happy there?
Oh, no, I was... I made a mistake. I got out too early. I'll explain why. My mother was very anxious for me to come home. I made a few inquiries, and I found the... I got hold of the chap who was in charge of demobilisation papers in the ship's office, and I wangled my papers through. Some of them took many weeks, but mine went through very quickly. I came home in February on a Sunday. And on the Monday morning, I went to the office, the factory, you see, to tell them that I was home, you see. And F.S. Philpott, who was the manager, looked up from his desk and he said, "Oh, so you're back, Bryce. Well, start next Monday." Now, in that 12 months, at 18, I'd grown. And he just gave me that bare week. And I went back to work, and we were working all the hours you could mention. Fellows that I had been working with who were had gone over to the... Army of Occupation in Germany, they were sending letters back about how they were having sports days and goodness knows what. There was us working till goodness knows what time at night, you see. And also, they were benefiting financially because the company was making up their pay, you see. And I had been so keen to get out that... I lost all that.
You had to work for
it. I had to work for it, yes. I always remember a colleague of mine when he got married and he bought a house, and I said, "Well, I don't know how you managed to save enough money to buy a house." Oh, he said, "That was easy." He said, all the time I was in the army, he said the company were making up my pay, and he said I had 2 years in the army of occupation. So he said all that money went into my bank account.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bryce.
I don't.